Steve Boner.
I'm Chip Hassenflow.
And I'm Pam Bedore.
And we are back on a Sunday for Chapter 8 of The Sign of Four, more fun adventures with Scooby-Doo.
Scooby-Doo, the predecessor, Steve, Toby, the Scooby-Doo before Scooby-Doo.
Scooby-Doo's great-grandfather, Toby. Holmes and Watson are still on the trail of the creosote-laden acrobat that they're searching all over London, and Toby is still trying to find his way. Watson doesn't think that Toby's the right choice for this investigation, huh?
But Sherlock defends the trustworthy Toby. He says, evidently what puzzled the dog at the corner of Knight's Place was that there were two different trails running in opposite directions. We took the wrong one. It only remains to follow the other. And of course, Sherlock is right. They follow the second path, which takes them to a wharf where the suspect evidently took a boat. So, go Toby. He's good.
Yay.
He's on the right path. There were only two paths, and so they apparently the dog chose one of the two paths, but that was the wrong one, so they went back. They backtracked, literally, and went down the other path. They get to Mordecai Smith's place, and the boatman Mordecai Smith isn't there. His wife and his son are there, and the wife is very concerned for her husband's well-being.
And she notes that he was hired by a wooden-legged man. Dun, dun, dun.
a pirate, probably.
That's why he's getting on a boat, yes.
Right? He actually calls him a brown monkey-faced chap, but whatever. Yeah.
That would be rewritten.
Yes.
I wrote that in the notes because a certain gentleman on this podcast has a theory about the other man, the one that doesn't have the wooden leg, might not actually be a man, might actually be some sort of simian, right, Chip?
Well, you know, I am a silverback myself, Steve, on my grandmother's side, long way away. But so I can throw that out there.
But it's interesting to think that maybe, just maybe, we're looking for something that is not a human being in the other man. And we'll find out. We have no great clues here, but we'll find out. They get a description of the boat from the wife of Mordecai Smith, and they immediately call the police to tell them to look for this boat, right?
Not no. Eggs.
No, no. Welcome to Sherlock Holmes stories. The wife says that the boat has been freshly painted black with two red streaks. And this is given a very strong word in the text here. Like, we are really going to pay attention to the color of this boat. Holmes employs the Columbo method of interrogation here, doesn't he?
That was hilarious. I was sitting there going... He kept going on like a circular request for the information on this boat, and she kept like providing the information, and he was getting it wrong, and then he would provide it back again.
Acting as if he didn't understand the information from the witness is kind of key to getting the trust of a certain group of people to get them to give you the information without thinking about whether or not they should be doing so.
And Holmes actually explains this to Watson after they leave the Smith household. He says, the main thing with people of that sort is never to let them think that their information can be of the slightest importance for you. If you do, they will instantly shut up like an oyster. If you listen to them under protest, as it were, you are very likely to get what you want. So a little reverse psychology here from Sherlock Holmes. Now, this is one of my favorite parts of the chapter where Watson says, well, I guess it's clear what we need to do next. And Holmes is like, oh, what do you think it is? He's like, okay, we should go down the river and look for the boat. My dear fellow, it would be a colossal task, says Holmes. Oh, okay, well, maybe we could tell the police about the boat. No, I shall probably call Athelney Jones in at the last moment. He's not a bad fellow, and I should not like to do anything which would injure him professionally, but I have a fancy for working it out myself now that we have gone so far. Oh, says Watson, well, maybe we should advertise for the information. To which Sherlock says, worse and worse. And so all of Watson's ideas are completely put aside. You know, I think it's interesting that Holmes is like, Athelney Jones, not a bad guy. Don't forget, he has arrested like everybody he can find on this case, right? Mm-hmm. But Holmes wants to do it himself, but then he does plan to turn over what he finds.
This is so typical of these stories. Sherlock Holmes does not work well with the police. He wants to do it himself for nothing more than the game itself. He's not looking to be famous from this. He just wants to do it himself. Very interesting character, this Sherlock Holmes of which you speak.
And of course, he becomes very famous because of that. So imagine that, Steve. Imagine that, Pam.
He stops on his way home and sends a telegram to somebody really important to Chapter 8, Pam.
Indeed, the chapter title, The Baker Street Irregulars. And I love how he reminds Watson. He says, you remember the Baker Street Division of the Detective Police whom I employed in the Jefferson Hope case? Well, said I, laughing, this is just the case where they might be invaluable. If they fail, I have other resources, but I shall try them first. That wire was to my dirty little lieutenant, Wiggins, and I expect that he and his gang will be with us before we have finished our breakfast. So he is calling in the kids.
You can just imagine them showing up with their great big hats on.
Oh, I love when they show up. We'll get to that in a second. Because that is probably my favorite part of this chapter is when the kids actually show up. But this idea of this army of little kids that Sherlock Holmes pays handsomely to be his eyes and ears on the street is pretty brilliant writing here.
And yeah, they got the latest technology. They can receive the telegram.
Okay, I thought about that. I thought about that. Where does he send the telegram? Right?
See, this is not about logic. Just go with it.
These are homeless kids on the streets of London. Do they check their email that often, really?
Clearly they do, because the little band of Baker Street Irregulars shows up right on cue.
They
post it on like a you know, some wall somewhere that they just kind of run by.
I guess it would make sense for them to go to the telegram office every once in a while to check if there's a message from Sherlock Holmes. Maybe it would even make sense for Sherlock Holmes to pay the telegraph operator to bring it to these kids, to know where these kids stay, I guess. But it did strike me as odd, for sure.
Absolutely agree. Me too.
Watson describes a deep internal struggle that he has in this particular case. This is, I gotta tell you, the best character development that we have gotten out of John Watson for the entire run of the canon. This is where we really get to know him and his internal ideas. He said, I had not the professional enthusiasm which carried my companion on, nor could I look at the matter as a mere abstract intellectual problem. As far as the death of Bartholomew Sholto went, I had little good of him and could feel no intense antipathy to his murderers. The treasure, however, was a different matter. That, or part of it, belonged rightfully to Miss Morstan. While there was a chance of recovering it, I was ready to devote my life to the one object. True, if I found it, it would probably put her forever beyond my reach. Yet it would be petty and selfish love which would be influenced by such a thought as that. If Holmes could work to find the criminals, I had a tenfold stronger reason to urge me on to find the treasure. That's a lot of character development in one paragraph.
Can we go ahead and cue the love theme once again? John Williams, go ahead. Right there. Love theme.
And it's great that, like, Watson understands his own selfishness, and he's like working to get past it. He's working to transcend his own pettiness and selfishness. And so he wants his love for Mary to be pure, which means helping her to find the treasure, even though it certainly means she would not consider him as a legitimate suitor. I also think it's interesting that he notes that he doesn't feel any intense antipathy towards Bartholomew's murderers.
Like, I'm sorry, who?
That Watson.
Bartholomew!
I'm sorry, I was like, oh, did I misspeak?
We're just going to have to throw that on forever because that's just too cool.
I think that it's interesting that he feels no intense antipathy to the murderers of Brother Bartholomew. Because, you know, I mean, he hung out with his twin brother for a while, you know, gave him medical advice of all kinds. I don't know. It seems like
he's totally distracted by Mary. 100%. He's not on this case for anything other than the payoff for this one person.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Hey, Steve, can we get to that part where the London version of the Little Rascals shows up?
Yes. This is wonderful. These characters are beloved, and this is one of the reasons why. Here's the paragraph where the Baker Street irregulars come in. There came a swift pattering of naked feet upon the stairs, a clatter of high voices, and in rushed a dozen dirty and ragged little street Arabs. There was some show of discipline among them, despite their tumultuous entry, for they instantly drew up in line and stood facing us with expectant faces. One of their number, taller and older than the others, stood forward with an air of lounging superiority, which was very funny in such a disreputable little scarecrow. This just makes me smile just reading that paragraph.
Can we call that one Alfalfa?
This is why we love the Little Rascals, right? We love the idea of these kids with all of their characteristics, every single one of them being different. And Doyle doesn't even have to write every single one of them. It's just the tumult of all of these little faces running into the room. We have this idea in our heads.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You can picture these kids so easily. And then Holmes is using them to full advantage, right? He pays each of them for a day's work. He says whoever finds the boat will get an extra reward, and he sends them on their way. It would be a colossal task for him and Watson to go down the river looking at every little boat here and there and everywhere, but these kids, they won't even be noticed as they're doing their super thorough investigation. And like it sounds like Holmes has them very well trained.
After breakfast, they read the newspaper account. "Isn't it gorgeous?" said Holmes, grinning over his coffee cup. "What do you think of it?" Watson replies, "I think that we have had a close shave ourselves of being arrested for the crime." Now, this is something that's come up so many times in the canon. These two guys should be arrested. They were at the scene of a crime. What is their reason for not being arrested?
Tampering with evidence, actually being at the crime when it happens. I mean, there's so many times where they could just say, well, we don't even need suspects. We'll just grab these two guys. Just happen to show up everywhere crime takes place.
Well, and especially that Athelney Jones has been arresting people left, right, and center, right? But Holmes kind of loves it that the newspaper account is so inaccurate. "Isn't it gorgeous?" he says. He's thrilled. Watson's like, "Buddy, we almost got arrested."
Again.
White. Amazing as Holmes does.
Oh, thank goodness they're the good guys.
And that has come up already. We've already gone through that conversation. Thank goodness Sherlock Holmes turned to a life of investigating instead of a life of crime, because he would make a great criminal. Doyle speaks directly to the audience here about the other suspect. This is, okay, it's Watson, but this is Doyle speaking to the audience in the voice of Holmes. "I have no wish to make a mystery of him, to you anyway, but you must have formed your own opinion. Now, do consider the data. Diminutive footmarks, toes never fettered by boots, naked feet, stone-headed wooden mace, great agility, small poison darts. What do you make of all this?" This is Sherlock speaking to Watson, but yeah, even more, this is Doyle speaking to us.
Very much inviting us to join that detective trope of fair play, where we, the reader, we can't beat Sherlock, but at least we might be able to figure it out before Watson. And Watson, of course, gets it wrong a couple times, but eventually he comes to the notion that this is some sort of Aboriginal person. And I don't feel like it's necessary to go through the racist details of the description of the Aborigines of the Andaman Islands. Are you guys cool with that?
I'm more than happy with that.
I just say, you know.
I think we can note that this was, at the time, this was a way of speaking that we would not be right. okay with today. And it all the information is there, and our listeners are welcome to read along with us, right. and hopefully they are. And we think it might be an Aborigine. The well, end.
Actually, I do want to note one or two small things, even as I'm like, let's not read through the whole section. But this is pretty typical Victorian description of the exotic other. Sherlock does use his encyclopedia, right? And he has like extensive, this comes back to Sherlock's extensive use of published research in thinking through his cases. But there's also this stereotype of the Aboriginal as a cannibal. And so that gets mentioned as well. And happily, my Penguin Edition footnote points out that that is not accurate at all of the Andaman Island Aboriginals. So. But we do have, you know, we do have this Good. Very Victorian representation of colonial peoples. So as we get to the end of this chapter, we get a preview of what's to come next, because Sherlock warns that they might have to pull another all-nighter tonight. Don't forget, they've been up all night. They've gone out and had all kinds of adventures, right? Think about all the things they've done. We're only like, what, 12 hours into this story, and we're on chapter 8. Mm-hmm. They've done, you know, Mary came to their house. They went to Thaddeus's house. They went to Schultz's house. They found the murder. Watson brings Mary home, picks up Toby. They take that 6-mile walk. Then they have the creosote barrel incident. They go to the river. I mean, a lot has happened. They have breakfast. The irregulars come by. I mean, it's like, what, 9 in the morning at this point. They haven't slept a wink.
And this is chapter 8.
I was just saying, we need a little musical.
Exactly. And Sherlock says, you know, we might have to do an all-nighter tonight. And Watson's like, oh, are you going to get some sleep? Sherlock's like, no, I'm not tired. I have a curious constitution. I never remember feeling tired by work, though idleness exhausts me completely. I'm going to smoke and to think over this queer business to which my fair client has introduced us.
And we've talked about this before. This is something that I actually agree with Sherlock on. When I'm in the middle of work, I am not uh-huh. as exhausted as I am when there's nothing to do. Idleness exhausts me. I hate summertime so much because I have so much downtime. I take naps all summer. But when there's work to be done, when the musical season is upon me, I am exhausted, but I'm working, and it's different.
It's a good kind of exhaustion. I know exactly. what you mean. Yeah.
You're in flow at that point. You right. you got it going. And you're right. Idle time certainly make you tired. This is one of the challenges of COVID.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We don't on this podcast recommend smoking your way through it, though, as Holmes does continually throughout the canon. Now, well, you know, it's funny because remember a couple chapters ago, Holmes said to Watson, is your leg okay to do 6 miles? And Watson's like, sure, it's fine. Here, Sherlock's a little bit more firm. Look here, Watson, you look regularly done. Lie down there on the sofa and see if I can put you to sleep. And this is the ending of the chapter. He took up his violin from the corner, and as I stretched myself out, he began to play some low, dreamy, melodious air. His own, no doubt, for he had a remarkable gift for improvisation. I have a vague remembrance of his gaunt limbs, his earnest face, and the rise and fall of his bow. Then I seemed to be floated peacefully away upon a soft sea of sound, until I found myself in dreamland, with the sweet face of Mary Morstan looking down upon me.
Aww.
And,
love. Sweet. Do you think Sherlock is at that point playing the love thing?
That he invented yeah. himself. His little improv.
That's twice in this chapter we get the love thing. Oh my goodness.
And this paragraph includes his bow, Chip, that you've been waiting for since we read his last bow.
Exactly. That's my favorite part. You know, this will probably, the American version ends with a marriage. I just want to throw that out there. But everyone else doesn't get a marriage. All American films have happy endings, right?
Oh, you're talking about the Hound of the Baskervilles ending when they walk off into the sunset and fall in love? Aww. This is adorable. This is sweet again, really great character development from Doyle. This is the best character development we've ever gotten for John Watson.
It's awesome.
Agree. So we are off to chapter 9, which presumably will have more to do with evidence, a break in the chain.
So maybe there's something's going to happen in chapter 9. We'll have to find out when we come back tomorrow to discuss it. I hope you're all thinking about all these issues and keeping with us and keeping with Doyle on this investigation, on this mystery, and using your mind and trying to solve it along with Watson. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Give us a voicemail, an email. We'd love to see your pictures of John Watson falling in love with Mary Morstan. We would love to see. Where's Toby? We would love somebody draw me a picture of Toby. That's what I want to see.
Toby the dog. He looks like Scooby Doo. Just so if you need a
he doesn't
reference.
Look like Scooby Doo. I disagree with you. put the hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes on all of that information out there on the internet, and we will see it and we will discuss it. Just like going, you know, to a castle and seeing these sorts of places. That would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Thanks, Steve. I totally forgot to tell you guys. So today I took my kids to Gillette Castle in Connecticut, which is where William Gillette, the first guy to really make Sherlock Holmes huge on the stage. He has this beautiful property and now it's a state park. And so, of course, the museum is closed because of COVID. But it's a beautiful state park, wonderful hiking trails. Everyone was very socially distancing. People had their masks available for when you met on the trails. So it was a really, really, really nice day. And if anyone's in the Connecticut area, I definitely recommend a trip to Gillette's Castle.
Awesome. We'll put a link to that in the show notes for you to find Gillette's Castle and keep up with all the information from 120 years ago and all the thoughts about how all this can really have an impact on our day. This has been great. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hasselflug.
And I'm Pam Fedor. I just want to think for things that we don't talk about. What I want to talk about is what I want to thank you for. What I want to thank you for. It means so very much to me without you. I would never see the light. You're my dirty little lieutenant.
Brother Bartholomew.
Isn't it time for some Scooby snacks?
Zoinks!